So now we have Mr. Robert Schneiker here to speak about the mystery of Göbekli Tepe. So Robert Schneiker has been conducting research on the age of the Sphinx for the past 7 years. Schneiker holds an MS in geology and geophysics from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and has worked in the environmental consulting industry since 1982. Currently, Schneiker provides support and training for the SeaView Containment Transport and Fate Modeling software that he developed. He has presented scientific papers in the United States, the European Union, and Canada. Give a warm welcome to Mr. Robert Schneiker.
Thank you. I bet you're all wondering why a geologist is giving a presentation on an obscure archaeological site in Turkey at the Freethought Festival. None of this makes any sense. But it all comes down to the Joe Rogan podcast. So how many people are watching Joe Rogan on occasion? So, and on this program, he has a number of different scientists. He has, you know, conspiracy theorists, all sorts of different people. People of my generation really don't know much of who Joe Rogan is. I always point out that it's the program in which Elon Musk smoked a joint. So a lot of times people will kind of remember, you know, like, you know, some vague idea of that. And what's really interesting is to just see the number of people that have watched these. So, I mean, you've got Elon Musk, 30.8 million views on YouTube. And all the numbers that you're seeing here, those account for probably about 25% of the actual views or people who've listened to it as a podcast or listened to it on satellite radio. So these numbers are quite high. But, you know, I just grabbed some of the names, and there's over, it's like 1,500 different programs at this point. But you've got people like Bernie Sanders. I'm sure everyone here knows who Neil deGrasse Tyson is. How many people know who Graham Hancock is? Yeah, so this is, again, you've got Graham Hancock here. He's got 6.4 million views. Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson, 6.4 million views again. They're on several times. Here's Neil deGrasse Tyson again. Brian Cox is a physicist. Got a thumbs up on that. Randall Carlson, here, you've seen him before, I mean, on this list. So he is really, from what I can gather, pretty much a handyman, who is a conspiracy theorist, self-taught geologist of sorts, and he just gets a little bit of geological information and defines some sort of catastrophic event that happened from that. And there's this one particular episode here, which is where Michael Shermer was on with Graham Hancock. Do people know Michael Shermer is?
Yes.
So Michael Shermer has Skeptic magazine, so he's fighting all of this stuff, and it's one of the few instances where anybody's gone on and take on the conspiracy theorists in terms of the nonsense that they're saying about the Sphinx being older and ancient aliens and lost civilizations and all of that. Robert Schock here, just I put on the list, he's actually a geologist, a geophysicist, and he's the person who like 30 years ago went to the Sphinx and said it was weathered by precipitation, which proves that it's older, so it's somewhere between 5,000 years, maybe 12,000 years, maybe 32,000 years, maybe 36,000 years, perhaps as much as 800,000 years various people have thrown out for the age of the Sphinx. John Anthony West is an anti-science, pro-magic guy who is, he was reading some stuff, and he's the one who actually proposed that the Sphinx was weathered by precipitation and then shopped around till he found a geologist who believed him. Robert Schock also has written books on parapsychology. You can move objects with your mind. So I'm not sure what kind of a geologist he is. Sean Carroll is a physicist who's been on there. Brian Cox again, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Brian Green was just on. And you can just see these numbers are quite high. They're higher than many of the NOVA science programs that are being broadcast on public television. So this presentation, actually I should back up, came from this podcast on the Joe Rogan Show. I started exchanging a couple of emails with Michael Shermer regarding his appearance on this, and I was pointing out that the evidence that they were presenting was wrong. So Michael Shermer's on there saying, this is just crazy. There weren't ancient aliens. There's no lost civilization. There's no evidence for any of this nonsense. Why are you saying this? And they kept, you know, presenting evidence, and he didn't really counter that evidence. So the consensus is, for the people who've watched that program, is that Michael Shermer lost the debate. That Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson just took it hands down. So I was exchanging a couple of emails, and from that, I started, you know, I put together some thoughts, and I watched the whole Joe Rogan program again, and Michael said, would you be interested in writing an article for my magazine? And I'm like, sure. And the reason is that I was interested is because the number one thing that to prove that there's ancient aliens and lost civilizations is the Sphinx. So that's number one on the list. So now this is number two. So I thought, yeah, I definitely want to learn more about this. And what this is here's a plot to show how this, even though you don't know, even if you don't know who Joe Rogan is and you don't know who Graham Hancock is, look at how the views are changing. Since 2015 to 2018, it went from 20% of the American population who believed that there were ancient aliens. It's now 41%. So 41% of Americans believe that the professors at the universities are straight out lying to them on this. And that's the way and Graham Hancock actually makes statements about the professors lying and saying that that they are the pseudoscientists. Graham Hancock and these guys, these are the real scientists. They're the ones telling you the truth. And you can also see that belief in Atlantis has jumped from 40% in 2016 to 57% now. So even though you don't know who these people are, you don't know all this, this is having an impact in our society. So Göbekli Tepe is an archaeological site in southeast Turkey, and it's near the Syrian border. It's right there. And it was originally looked at, it was as part of a survey of different sites in the area. From 1963 to 72, they went out and they cataloged different areas, and they just picked it out as saying it's something interesting, but they didn't have the money to go out there and explore it at the time. And that didn't start until 1995, when Klaus Schmidt from the German Archaeological Institute went there. And what he found was just really amazing, because it's basically, you can kind of think of it as a series of stone henges all next to each other, not just one. And the area, the site itself, is like 1,000 feet across. And each one of these structures is somewhere between 30 to 100 feet across these sections here. And I mean, so the best analogy, like I said, is that, and it's like 50 feet tall. So it's the best analogy is it's kind of like a stone henge. And here's a close-up or a different view of that, and you can see there's these circular enclosures with there's two T-pillars in the middle and these other T-pillars around and others in the area. And this grid here, this is the way they're just excavating the area. So some of these pillars are up to 18 feet tall. They're quite massive. And here's an aerial view. So what you see is there's these two T-pillars in the middle sort of facing each other, then a series of T-pillars in the walls, and they all face the interior. And there's actually different layers. It seems like year after year, sometimes they would just build another set of another wall and make it a smaller enclosure and then a smaller enclosure as time went on. And the number of these enclosures, the number of the pillars in these outer walls varies quite a bit. So this is what the T-pillars look like. If they weren't propped up today, they would fall over. And they're quite massive. And they're very distinct T-shaped pillars. And the thought is that maybe the area was roofed, because this is an earthquake area, and they're not set into the ground very far. So they'd almost certainly fall over if it weren't for the fact that they had some sort of support. And that roof would have also provided some protection from the elements, and there's some thought that at least for some of the enclosures, the entrance was actually through the roof. So you didn't come in through a doorway, you went in through a roof. And basically, this is what the T-pillars look like. You have, it's basically a person. So it's a person standing like this, and their arms are in this position, and then their fingers come around to the front. So there's no face. They never have a face, so this is basically the head. Here's the arm coming down, here's the fingers, here's a belt, and a loincloth. And there's some thought that this is, that they may represent individuals within the community or certain groups within the community that each of these different pillars represent. And this picture, by the way, is by Jens Notroff, who is one of the principal researchers at Göbekli Tepe. And what's also interesting is that there's a number of the excavations have been, of these enclosures have been excavated, and a lot of the T-pillars are just covered with art. Tremendous amount of art on each of them. And what's interesting is, I mean, it's mostly snakes and foxes and vultures, but then at the same time, individual enclosures have specific animals. So enclosure C, it's boars, and D, it's birds, B, it's foxes, and A, snakes. So it's kind of interesting to see that they did that. And there's no question that these pillars tell a story. And the question, what is the story? It's think a stained glass church window. But if you didn't know what the stained glass, if you didn't know the story of Jesus and the virgin birth, and you look at the window, you wouldn't be able to tell anything from it. And that's what's happening here, is people are looking at this, but they can't quite figure out what's going on. And it's interesting because here they have, I looked at this and I was like, so the conspiracy theorists, by the way, have figured this out. These are man bags, and they've seen these in other statues elsewhere, and they normally have a hand holding what looks like a little bag. But these actually, my guess is this is a representation of Göbekli Tepe itself. And above each one of these entrances in the roof is a different animal. And it shows that going down. So they were roofed. This looks like wheat to me. What's interesting is you have, this is a vulture, and it's holding a round object. That's thought to be a human head. Many of the depictions of humans, here's a depiction of a human down here. This is a headless person with an erect penis. And so there's a lot of depictions like that. All of the animals and all of the humans where you can discern that are male. There's only one exception, and it's almost certainly graffiti. The style of it is very different than anything else at Göbekli Tepe. So it's interesting, too, because the site was abandoned. So not only... there's a couple of things going on. It's just through time, they started out with pillars. You can see these are quite massive, quite large. And this is basically an insert to scale. And so over about almost 2,000 years, they went from these massive T-pillars to these much smaller T-pillars and enclosures. Some of these don't contain any of the pillars in the walls, and others don't even contain the two central pillars. So instead of you normally think through civilizations and societies through time, they become more and more complex. You'd expect this to grow, and then instead you're finding that there's actually a decline and then an eventual abandonment of the site. Göbekli is Turkish for pot belly or belly, so it's they're saying it looks like this part of a human body. Well, and that's this section right here. And a tell or a tepe is an artificial hill. And the classic example of an artificial hill is Jericho. And there it's a city that was built in the same spot, year after year, hundreds of years. And as the walls collapse, the new city, the new buildings were put on top of that. And they just contain an archaeological record. They're a treasure trove of information. But Göbekli Tepe didn't form that way. They intentionally filled these excavations. So if it's not mysterious enough, they went out there and for some reason just decided to put some objects in there, some statue heads and things like that, and then bury the whole site. And then move on to the next one. So it's not known how long each particular enclosure was used. And I suggested to one of the researchers that perhaps this was the different clans. And if a particular group fell out of favor, maybe that group's enclosure is just eliminated. You're not welcome at the site anymore. You're not part of our group. And he thought that was interesting. The fill material consists of fist-sized to about head-sized rubble. And a lot of flint tools and arrowheads and stone tools also contains a massive amount of animal bones. And these animal bones were all smashed to get to the marrow with inside the bones. And they're only wild species of animals that have ever been detected here. Nothing is domesticated. And the oldest date that they have at the site is about 11,700 years to 11,300 years before present. And I forgot to mention, so BP means before present. And that dates not the construction of when that enclosure was made, but when that enclosure was filled. And Klaus Schmidt, the original excavator, he thought that the site might be 14, maybe even 15,000 years old. This is amazing because hunter-gatherers weren't supposed to be able to make things like this, nothing of this sort of scale. And the fill material, like I said, contains human bones. These are kind of like an exception of the most spectacular bones that they found are pieces of human skulls. And they've been clearly modified. And they were modified shortly after the person died or was killed. They can tell that by the sharpness of the cuts into the bones, that these bones were still soft at the time that they were being modified. And but the other bones that are human, they have defleshing cut marks. So is this part of one of the thoughts is that this site might be a sky burial site, where people would take a body and cut it up into pieces and then put it out for the vultures and other birds to feed on and carry the bones and the flesh away. So that's one of the thoughts that they were having at this. There's no sign at this point of cannibalism, but it's sort of implied, but there's actually no clear signs that any cannibalism occurred at this site. What's interesting is one of the skulls has a hole at the top of the head. So it's been suggested, this is a reconstruction, that they actually took these skulls and they put them on display. So a couple thousand years after, maybe even at this time, people did really weird things when a relative died. You would take them and you would bury them in your house. It wouldn't be very deep. You'd just dig maybe 2 to 3 feet down, and you'd cover it up and you'd leave the body there for about a year. Then you dig up that body and you take off the head and you deflesh it and cover it with clay and use shells for eyes, for kind of like squinting eyes, and you'd put it on the shelf with all the other skulls. That's what they were doing back at that time. So it's actually the part of the Neolithic skull cult, so it's not a surprise that they actually did this. Based on ground-penetrating radar, it turns out that the biggest enclosures, these are the ones that are already excavated, there's even larger enclosures that have yet to be excavated. So using this decline in scale through time, it indicates that it might even be older. That's part of the indication on that. And it's not in isolation. There are other T-pillar sites all over the area. So this is just a depiction of a few. They just started excavating at two of these. And at one of those two, there's 266 T-pillars. So this is not the only place where they're finding these sort of T-pillars. Where they actually first found them was at Novelli Quarry, which is a site right here. And that was excavated at the time by the German, in the 80s, because of the German Archaeological Institute. And they were excavating it because a dam was being built and they were going to flood the area. So they needed to excavate that quickly before it was flooded. And there, that's where they first saw the T-pillars. So finding T-pillars was nothing unusual when they went to Göbekli Tepe. Everyone thinks that the T-pillars were unique. No, they already knew of those. What's unique about it is just the scale of what it is that they're doing. That they were hunter-gatherers spending a huge amount of time that it doesn't even seem like a typical hunter-gatherer group could have enough people to build anything like this. So you had to bring people together, you had to supply them with food, you had to do all sorts of different things, you had to coordinate this, you had to quarry. And that just goes beyond any archaeologist's view of what a hunter-gatherer was capable of doing. So it's often considered the world's first temple. They don't really like that now. Klaus Schmidt was talking about it that way a lot. The reason they don't like the idea of it being a temple, because that implies that there's some sort of spiritual leader. And they don't know that kind of detail about this site, that there's any one particular person or individuals that were like the leaders within the group. So they were hunter-gatherers, which is, you know, they foraged for what they could find. It was an endless search for food, and, you know, they did that for at least 200,000 years, which is really the age of our species. So as long as we've been human, that's the way that we were living our lives. Any technology they had to carry it. There was no, at Göbekli Tepe, there's no farming, no domestication. It was definitely not also, in the next slide, it was definitely not a village. This is not a location where anybody lived. They went there for just gathering purposes. So it looks like now that it's part of this tradition that hunter-gatherers had, where they would come together with various groups and they would exchange information, they'd have big feasts, and, you know, the exchange marriage partners. Göbekli Tepe appears to be part of that huge festival-type situation. And the volume of bones that they found says that this was, you know, they were feasting on a massive scale. The amount of food that was there, the amount of food that they're finding in the bones that they're finding, just say this is just crazy, a lot of food. And it probably also involved alcohol, most likely beer. So it's an archaeological enigma. How in the world did they build this? How is it possible that hunter-gatherers could have enough food, basically, to feed all of these people and build it? So the standard paradigm until Göbekli Tepe was that the first thing you had to do was invent farming. Once you invented farming, then you created a food surplus. Once you had a surplus, you'd settle in communities. There you develop the social hierarchy, and then eventually you'd construct things like Göbekli Tepe. This was the basic paradigm that they were using. And so it's the basic, it's farming first. The problem is getting enough food together for such large groups of people. And that's why the farming had to come first. So it doesn't fit the standard paradigm. And to archaeologists, it made no sense. Even the feasting is like off scale in terms of what people were capable of, what they thought people were capable of doing. And the deliberate burial just deepens the mystery on this whole thing. Why did they do that? So we have the Neolithic Revolution, and that's when farming started. And that the original farming, the first indications that of any domesticated wheat or any animals comes from Novelli Quarry, the site that Klaus Schmidt was excavating just prior to Göbekli Tepe. But that's about the time that Göbekli Tepe was abandoned. And whatever's going on here, it seems to have something to do with the Ice Age in terms of why farming, and it's still a mystery as to how farming got started. Nobody really knows. So it has a lot to do with orbital forcing. So what you have is on the top there, it's showing how the angle of the Earth varies between 22 and 24 degrees. How far does the Earth tilt over? And so that's going to change the amount. This is looking at the northern hemisphere. What's the intensity of the sunlight reaching the northern hemisphere? Then this is the eccentricity of the orbit, which is basically because Jupiter and to some extent Saturn are changing the shape of Earth's orbit. And so sometimes we're closer to the sun, sometimes we're a little further from the sun, and that changes the intensity of light that you're going to get, sunlight that you're going to get in the northern hemisphere. The other one here is the precession of the equinox. And that is the Earth is spinning like a top, if you'd see it. And what's happening is that the amount of sunlight varies depending upon where you are in that. And so right now, we are at the closest approach to the sun when we're in winter. And about 10,000 years ago, or in the future, we'll be at the closest approach to the sun in the northern hemisphere summer. And so that's what changes, and that's what ended the Ice Age right here. This is the end of the Ice Age because we're getting, so this is the combination of all those different plots showing how much energy's hitting the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere, it doesn't matter as much because there's ocean currents that distribute that heat and cold more evenly, so it's all dependent upon mostly the northern hemisphere. So what happened is that you get this event called the Bowling Alarod. And the Earth came out of the Pleistocene Ice Age, and it went into a temperate period, which is very much like now. And if you were in Turkey at that time, the area is just covered with wild grains. And think of the Great Plains with buffalo herds, it's like that. But, and there's settlements in Syria that date to this time, and most likely there's sites within Turkey that are dated to this time interval between 14,000 and about 13,000 years ago. Right after that came what's called the Younger Dryas. And this is a return to Ice Age conditions. And exactly what caused this, nobody's really sure. Best guess is that you take all this meltwater, that's all these ices melting on the continents, and the ocean levels came up a total of 400 feet. We're about halfway through it at this point. And the idea is all that light fresh water turns off the Gulf Stream. When you turn off the Gulf Stream, you don't bring the heat from the equator to the north, and the northern hemisphere goes back into Ice Age conditions. So, and now at this point, the wheat, which was just prevalent all across the area, all these wild grains, is confined to very small areas. But still, the sites in Syria were continuously inhabited during this time period. And it's named after, it's called the Younger Dryas. The Dryas is a flower, and it's based, and it does very well under the cooler conditions. And that's why I've got that's the very flower right there. And the amount of pollen that's found in the cores from this time period is what sets that to be the Younger Dryas. And yes, there is an older Dryas. After the Younger Dryas, you get to the Holocene. And that's the time period that we're in now. And so this area goes back to wheat is just everywhere. This is the Fertile Crescent. So this is where civilization started. This is where agriculture started. This is where wheat was domesticated. The DNA evidence points all this stuff right there. And here's Göbekli Tepe, and you can see that you've got barley and two different types of wheat. They all overlap in this area, and the Valley Kori is up here. Without question, this is where farming started. And so these people, it turns out that there was a researcher from the University of Illinois, and he went to this very area in 1967. And he said, I'm a professor, I got soft hands. And the first thing he did is he went out and he collected wheat and other grains by just pulling them off the stem with his hands. And he saw what he could collect that way. Then he went out with a sickle, with flint for the blades, and he cut down wheat, and he just collected it. And then he figured out how much he collected. And his assessment was that he could collect, well, that a family back 12,000 years ago, working for just 3 weeks, could collect more wheat and other grains than they could possibly eat in a year. So they didn't have to have farming. And so all of a sudden now we can see how they were able to do this. They were what was called affluent foragers. And you got wheat that can be stored, so now they've got a food that they can store for many, many years. And they just, you know, from that is how they were able to build Göbekli Tepe. And so Klaus Schmidt, the German researcher, says, you know, it didn't change history, but it adds a chapter. And it makes no difference if the wheat is gathered or, you know, planted or just simply gathered. They had all the benefits of farming without the work. So, like I say, it's a new chapter. And it created a new paradigm, which is, instead of the farming first, farming is last. So now you go out there and you collect your wild grains, you create a food surplus, you settle in communities, you develop a social hierarchy, you construct megalithic architecture, and then somewhere in there, you start farming. So farming has now become the last thing on the list instead of the first. And so the Göbekli Tepe's flipped that all over. So the conspiracy theorists obviously take a different view of all of this. To them, you've got the Great Sphinx. These are actual titles. This is one of Robert Schoch's. The Great Sphinx, Göbekli Tepe, and the Origins of Civilization. So what they're saying is Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old, just like they said. Well, except they said 5,000 and 32,000 and 36,000 and 800,000. Forget all those. They did throw out, one of the numbers they threw out was, in fact, around 12,000 years ago. This is the proof that they were looking for. an older Sphinx no longer exists in isolation, the archaeologists will have to concede that they're just plain wrong. That Göbekli Tepe is that proof. Because one of the arguments when the archaeologists were saying that the older Sphinx couldn't possibly exist because there's no civilization capable of building something like the Sphinx. And their argument is, well, if they could build Göbekli Tepe, they could build the Sphinx. And they see the younger Dryas entirely different, too. They say it begins and it ends with a comet impact. And the first one produces a cooling event. The second impact creates a warming event that floods Atlantis and causes a worldwide flood, too. And in both, and so what they do, none of this makes any sense. So everything that they have is dependent upon these comet impacts. There's little evidence of either of these impacts, although there is some evidence for it, but there's none for a lost civilization, and there's certainly no evidence of Atlantis. And what they're saying then happened is, some of them at least, they're saying there was this technology transfer. So you have the date of 11-6 at... What?
What is Atlantis?
Oh, Atlantis is a city that, or civilization that was flooded. That's a good question, but it was basically a lost civilization that was flooded about 12,000 years ago.
Is it real?
No. It is not real. So what they did in 11,600 years ago, the survivors of this event that happened at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, so almost 13,000 years ago, and the survivors somehow, what happened at the end of the Younger Dryas, they all went to Göbekli Tepe, and they taught the people of Göbekli Tepe two things. They did this technology transfer. They taught them, number one, how to make megalithic architecture, which they probably have been doing already for 1,000 or perhaps 2,000 years. And then the other thing that they did is they taught them how to farm. But there's no evidence of farming at Göbekli Tepe. So they didn't use that. So there's this technology transfer, and even Graham Hancock says it didn't quite work. So, like I say, they're already building megalithic architecture. What they're dating is when they actually, the date comes from not the construction of these enclosures, but when they abandoned the enclosures. So just at the time this lost civilization comes to save them, they like start burying things. And also starts the decline. There's not an increase in what's going on in terms of their capabilities. This marks the beginning of a solid decline in the structures that they're building at Göbekli Tepe. And eventually they abandon the site, and they never used farming. And they also say that this civilization, it just disappeared. It's interesting, they survived two comet impacts and a worldwide flood, but during the stable period in the Holocene, they disappear without a trace. So what's going on here? So, you know, that's quite the understatement to say it didn't quite work. So meantime, while this is happening, I got to bring the Sphinx back in here. While they gave the people at Göbekli Tepe farming and megalithic architecture, they were constructing the Sphinx and the Hall of Records. And the Hall of Records is this supposed library that contains information and knowledge beyond anything that we know today. And they were using acoustic levitation and other advanced technologies to build the Sphinx, the same people. So why weren't they applying this over at Göbekli Tepe? They made these people drag these blocks around when they could have been using levitation. And again, it didn't work. There's no continuous civilization from when the Sphinx was supposedly 12,000 years ago until now. So again, the whole thing, the whole area was just, I'll get to that. The area was great for conditions. So getting back to this, what happens is like I was saying, the northern hemisphere 10,000 years ago was leaning towards the sun in the summer, and that makes our summers slightly hotter. In particular, it made Europe hotter. And when Europe gets hot, the Sahara turns green. Because basically what's happening is that when there's hot air rising over the land in Europe, there's air coming from the south to replace that air, and that draws the monsoons over northern Africa, and the whole Sahara turns green. It is considered the world's largest open-air art gallery. There's artwork all over the Sahara. Without question, this has been going on for millions of years. To put this in perspective, how big this area is, this lake right here is Lake Mega Chad. The surface area is about 4.5 times that of Lake Superior. Without question, this was the world's largest lake at the time. So this was a great place to live. I want to make sure. So what also happened is that all that water, a lot of that water was being funneled down through the Nile Valley. And so it made the whole Nile Valley uninhabitable. It was really an Amazon of its day. And it just flooded the entire area. There's no way that anybody could have lived in the Nile Valley. So the Sphinx can't possibly, and what was going on, though, is that the limestone was being weathered away by karst limestone, by acidic action, and it was dissolving the limestone and creating a very, very soft rock from which the Sphinx was carved. So the Sphinx is not where you think it is. The most important thing to realize is that the Sphinx is 66 feet tall. It is also 66 feet above sea level. They keep talking about a Giza plateau. This is not a plateau. And the Nile River at that point is at about 50 feet above sea level. So there have been times when the Sphinx was actually in the Nile floodplain and it existed as an island in the Nile River during the extreme floods prior to the construction of the Aswan Dam. So if the Sphinx were 12,000 years old, if it existed when all this water was flowing down through the Nile, it would have erased the Sphinx. There'd be nothing left of this because it's a very soft stone. There's pieces of it, parts of it you could crumble in your fingers. It's that soft. None of this would be remaining. And at the very least, you'd have a bathtub ring where for thousands of years, this area was at least seasonally underwater. None of that exists. What's worse is that there's actually, so that when the Sahara turns green, it actually comes from the south, and the hotter Europe gets, the further north the rains are drawn, and the further north the Sahara turns green. So here's the site that's about 200 miles south of Cairo, and there's this artwork. And what they did is they dated it with optically stimulated luminescence. What they can do is they can take a portion of this site right here was buried, and there's artwork beneath it. So they removed the sand grains, and if you do it in darkness and then take it into a lab, you can figure out how long ago it was last exposed to sunlight. And so this artwork here is dated to 15,000 years old. And they got a really solid, good date on it. Also, it's fully exposed. You can see this person is in the daylight. There isn't the 2 to 3 feet of weathering that they're claiming happened on the surface of the Sphinx. If that amount of if the precipitation that fell during the African humid period occurred, then this artwork shouldn't even be here. This is, by the way, this is the oldest artwork in all of northern Africa. It's actually thought to be as much as 23,000 years old. So how did they build the Sphinx? Well, they built it using two-handed pounders, that's Mark Lehner who studies the Sphinx. So a two-handed pounder is just a rock. And you just take this rock and you bang on the surface of the limestone and you flake the other rock off. The other thing you do is you use the stone hammer, which is a smaller stone with two sticks, and you cut notches in the rock and you tie it together with leather and you've got a stone hammer and you pound that way. They use copper chisels, but they only use the copper chisels for detailed work. So that's how the Sphinx was made. And if it were weathered by erosion, by precipitation, you couldn't explain why this notch is here at the back of the head that would have been protected. At the same time, you'd also have to explain why this fracture here hasn't expanded. It's only on the surface that was carved, where you're seeing what people are describing as weathering. So the mystery of Göbekli Tepe was solved. It was built by affluent foragers. The farming first paradigm is wrong. The archaeologists have moved on, but the pseudo-archaeologists they're still using this outdated paradigm that farming has to come first, that Göbekli Tepe could not possibly have been built by hunter-gatherers. So they're stuck using this outdated paradigm. And they're asking the archaeologists to admit that they're wrong. And they did. They said, yes, you're right. Farming didn't come first. Now the archaeologists are asking the pseudo-archaeologists to admit that they're wrong. In the same way, that the farming first hypothesis just doesn't make any sense. I went through it a little quicker than I had hoped, but at least I didn't go long. Any questions?
Does the farming first hypothesis extend to other places, or I mean, is this an exception?
No, that's a good question. So the affluent foragers would include the Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest, where they were harvesting the salmon. And there's other places. There's some place in Australia where the Aborigines were considered affluent foragers. I don't remember where. For me, this was a real learning process because I'm not an archaeologist. And I just remember looking at this. I kept thinking, yeah, they're hunter-gatherers. But I'm not sure that term still applies. And it took me a long time to finally find that, yeah, there was another term that was being used, and that's the affluent forager. So there's a few places, but it's not that common.
Who were the animals? We know that when there were still big animals, we believe, there wasn't a reason to do the hard work of agriculture, because taking down something giant and furry could feed a village.
There were a lot of wild cattle and antelope and boars. I mean, I'm guessing they probably came through seasonally. But yeah, there was just a tremendous amount of food to be had, a tremendous amount of meat to be killed. Does that answer your
question? I was just curious, because the time frame, 10,000 plus years ago, was it kind of when we had the megafauna, you know, big antelope, big.
So that's kind of interesting, because that's also a very Eurocentric sort of view, because the megafauna extinction occurred in Australia about 45,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago when they got there. There was, for instance, Megalania, which was a 23-foot long Gila monster. That, can you imagine that humans? So Tim, one of the geologists down there, he says he describes it as a reasonably sized Tyrannosaurus rex, was living in Australia when humans first got there. So it turns out that the megafauna extinction, it's still being debated, but more and more the evidence is saying, no, that the timing of that occurs, and I had some slides on this, it does not apply to the end of the Ice Age. It just happened to do that because that's the time that people got to the Americas. But it has more to do when people get to an area, and that's when the megafauna extinction occurs. And in Africa, it's like it happened like a million years ago. And so, yeah, so there were large animals that were killed off at various times. So that's a very narrow view on the megafauna. And it was good when it was initially, that was a good idea, because we had mostly information from North America and Europe that we were basing this on.
When you're talking about the holes in the skulls and how they would like bury them like 2 to 3 feet and then pick them up, what other pieces are there that led you to that? Like, because I know like holes in the skulls could be like a number of things, like trepidation.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when I wrote an article and it's going to be published in Skeptic Magazine, and I tried putting in some speculation on my part. I got called on that so fast by the German researchers. But they're the ones that are saying that, no, the megafauna, I mean, the skull, they have that reconstruction. So a couple of things to that. The first thing is that the skull cult that I mentioned, really, that isn't firmly documented at Göbekli Tepe. That's more like what happened after Göbekli Tepe. And what they have in terms of those skull pieces, that's more of a recent paper where they had, where is that? Yeah, there it is. So they have all sorts, for whatever reason, kind of one of my own frustrations was they keep talking about human bones that they found in this excavation, and they keep saying that they're treated the same as the animal bones. But if you try to speculate that maybe there was cannibalism, they call you on that so fast. But what they had with these bones is they, and there's actual pictures, and you can find this article where they can, you can see there's cut marks in them and defleshing. I'm not sure, what was your question again? I want to make sure.
I was just wondering, like, because I feel like, is just the hole like enough evidence to like put that whole, like, they did this, this, and this together? I know some like groups would like put holes in heads to like free like evil spirits and like that sort of thing. Like, how do you?
That's a good question. I don't know. So the hole is just right there. So you don't even have a full hole. You only have part of that because it's half of the hole exists and the other half is gone wherever. And so yeah, when I saw that they took that, they took, you can just see these few pieces that they have here. You know, it's the skull right here, and how the, and they pieced them together and said that's all one skull, as opposed to this being a separate one. And from that, they came up with this. I was like, you know, that's a reach for me too. And I actually, one of the thoughts I had on this, and I got called on it, was you have the T-pillars, which don't have faces. And you've got the skull here that looks like it might have been hung. Well, maybe did they hang it on the T-pillar? And you know, that didn't go anywhere. So I don't know. They're pretty sure of this, and I don't know what other evidence there is to make them realize that they, to speculate that it was hung like this. And in fact, I had one of the other, I had another archaeologist look at this, and he didn't like my paper. He commented, you shouldn't use the word cult. He just didn't like that word. And I was like, I use cult? Where did I use cult? And then I went, oh, yeah, because of the skull cult. But that's in the title of the paper. I didn't use that. The archaeologists are using that. I'm like, I didn't use cult. They use cult. So yeah, I think going through this real quickly, the learning about archaeology, it doesn't have a unifying basis to it yet. It doesn't have a plate tectonics. I'm not sure what that would be because it seems like so many different people are off on different ways of looking at this, and there isn't one unified view is kind of what I took it. I don't know if that helps, but that was my view. Any other questions?
How was the Sphinx built?
How was the Sphinx built? That's a good question. So the Sphinx was built, it's actually a quarry. So imagine that this is the level of the ground is what I'm standing on. This is the surface. And I wanted to build a Sphinx here. So what I would do is I would carve down and remove the blocks and drag them this way. And the blocks that were being removed were being used to build two temples, the Sphinx and the Valley Temples. And that would leave a quarry. And what they did in the middle of that quarry is they left the block in place. And from that block, that solid rock that they left in place, they carved the Sphinx. But my opinion is when by the time they got around to carving it, that rock was so soft that they had to carve the at least the center section. So the lowest section, it's basically three different qualities of limestone. It's all limestone. The lower section is a so-so quality, hard, decent for carving, but not great. The middle section of the Sphinx is very soft, and sections of that you could just crumble in your fingers. The section that's the head, that's a really high quality limestone that is just ideal for carving from. And so what they did when they carved the Sphinx is the center section was actually covered with blocks, much like the pyramids. It had to be because the rock was just so soft. They couldn't carve the Sphinx. So what everyone is describing as weathering isn't weathering. It's part of that original construction process. Does that answer your question?
And like, if it's supposed to weather, then it did it.
Yeah, so it's normally considered, I think what you're saying is it's normally considered a monolith, and it's a lot of people have decided that the Sphinx was carved from a solid piece of rock from the very beginning, and that the rugged appearance that you see today is only a result of what has happened to it since this pristine structure was first made. And that doesn't fit. The rock was too soft by the time they got there. They actually uncovered a cave So one of the, because you get, it's karst limestone, so when they actually tried to excavate and build the Sphinx, they uncovered a cave, and that's why they extended the body, because they had to extend it over an area and fill that part with blocks. So and there's also a shelf. So the evidence is overwhelming that the Sphinx was never built as one solid piece. The head and the lower section of the rear paws, but the center section was covered with blocks, high quality blocks from the very beginning.
Is that where the Hall of Records supposedly is?
Yes, so the Hall of Records, good question. So the Hall of Records is under the left paw of the Sphinx. And what's really interesting is that Robert Schock says, this geologist, geophysicist, said that he found it using seismics. I'm like, you can't find the Hall of Records using the particular type of seismics that he used. And more than that, it would be underwater. Today, there's shallow water that's wicking up at the Sphinx. And so where the Hall of Records is, if you have papyrus scrolls there, they're gone. And in fact, it would be impossible to construct it in the first place because it's really underwater, and it's been underwater for thousands of years. I think that's it. Thank you.
All right, so a huge thank you to Robert Schneiker for that amazing discussion.